So I'm glad that you could make it today. There's a lot of... You all right, sitting back there?
Yeah,
I can't have so much eye contact.
No,
it's sort of behind the wall there.
Sorry.
So we try to keep this kind of teaching informal. That's the way that our group has been for many years. So please, you know, relax and feel free to ask questions as we go along. I might stop you if we ask too many questions, because then we don't get so far. And this is quite a long text or teaching to get through. So let's begin again with this same idea. So every teaching I'm going to say the same thing. It gets very boring, but it is so difficult to understand this, and so it's good to repeat the same thing over and over again. We cannot experience anything in our life unless this phenomena that we call mind interprets it to be a certain way. So it means that your mind is the source of all your experience. You cannot experience anything unless your mind tells you what's happening. Now, we believe that there is an objective world that exists separate from our own mind. It's just the way it is. There are mountains, there are trees, there are people, there's this, there's that. And they all exist a certain way. But we don't really understand how this experience of our world and the people in it actually arises to consciousness and our senses. We don't consider that at all. We just see everything as very, very solid and very kind of self-existent, independent of our own mind. And this is why we constantly react. We either react when we desire something, then we believe if we have the object, then it's going to give us some kind of pleasure. Or we try to push away whatever we don't like, because we believe that that particular object or that particular appearance is the cause of our displeasure. So we're constantly pulling different phenomena towards us and pushing other phenomena away from us, constantly pulling and pushing, pulling and pushing, never actually seeing how the mind is working to create this appearance of this phenomena in that moment. And this is what we have to look at, you know. Well, how does it work? How does it appear so real to us that we react constantly? And our reactions produce all our emotions. Without believing in an objective world out there existing separate from our own mind, then the emotions have no fuel. You have to have an object, an idea, in order for an emotion to arise. Just consider this. How can you get angry unless you have an idea? Ask yourself, how do you get angry? How do you feel? How do you feel desire for something unless the idea comes first? Jealousy. Any form of aggression. You must have an idea. And then you must believe in that idea. It exists as you think it does. This person is like this. This person's wrong. This situation is terrible. Now, why? You know, why should we believe in what we think? As we examine, we'll see that it's just a habit, a constant habit of attaching ourselves to whatever we think. The whole thought process, as the thoughts arise and pass away, we don't let them arise and pass away. We cling on to ideas, and then we build, we construct. Constantly constructing more and more our whole experience. And at the same time, we believe that this experience actually exists out there. It's actually like that. We ignore the fact that we are creating it through all our concepts. How does it work? Well, this is what we're going to look at. So, there's a saying from a great text called Uttara Tantra, and it says, "Beneath the poor man's house there is an inexhaustible treasure." But the pauper, the poor man, never realizes this, and the treasure never says, "I'm here." So likewise, the treasure of our own essence or our own nature, which is naturally pure, is trapped in what we call ordinary mind. Now, ordinary mind, last week I gave you a definition of mind. And I said that the idea, that this idea that I'm introducing, is this phenomena mind only functions when there is duality. So, mind is synonymous with ego. In order to have mind, we have to have a subject and an object, and they're constantly interacting. And it's this process of interaction between a subject and an object, this is what we call mind in this particular definition. Of course, you're going to hear many definitions. I'm not asking you just to stick with this one. But for this kind of teaching that we're going to go through, this is a very helpful definition to understand, that you cannot have a subject that's an idea of self unless you have an object, unless you believe that there is something out there. Because you have to have a perceiver to perceive it. Just consider this for a few moments. Yeah? So when there's no idea of an object, then how does the self work? This process of this idea of self work? It has to have something to play with. I like it or I don't like it, or I don't care. There's always something there. And as soon as there doesn't seem to be an object, then we create one, because it creates a sense of insecurity. So we always remain and suffer in poverty, because we don't see our own nature, we don't recognize our own nature. It's not that it's not there. Zongzi Kenzi gives a wonderful example, and he just says, you know, we're not here to introduce something new. We're not saying that, you know, you don't have a nature. It's just now we don't see the nature. So here's my smiley piggy. But if you don't see the smiley piggy, you don't know the smiley piggy's there. Mm. Yeah, so then this is the process that we're going to go through. It's a process of revealing what is there. Taking away all the veils, all the coverings, so that we can actually see our own nature. Because we don't see our own nature, then we act out of confusion. And this is the meaning of confusion, not recognizing your own nature. It has nothing to do with stupidity. Usually when we think of confusion, we think of stupidity. But Our confusion is very intelligent, because our confusion has to recreate this idea of self constantly. So it has a certain mechanism that recreates this feeling. There's something here, perceiving something there, and they both exist. How does this idea of self appear to you? Does it feel solid? What do you relate to as self? Think about it. When you say, I like something, what is it that likes? Or I dislike something, what dislikes?
It gives you definition. Gives you definition.
A definition?
If you like something or don't like something.
No, but what is it that likes or dislikes? It's not just definition, is it?
It gives you a definition,
yes. But it's such a solid feeling, isn't it? I don't like you. So what is it? Where is it? Because it causes us so much suffering, this idea of self.
It starts with a name. At first you give it a name. That immediately demarcates you from someone else with another name.
So I can blame my parents?
When all else fails.
Interesting though, isn't it? Because it happens at a time when you don't know that your hand is your hand. And that's the period of development. You see a hand and you don't realise it belongs to you. I don't know quite how old it is, but there is a...
Oh, I've actually heard the opposite. I heard that, you know, this differentiation is, it's not that you don't believe that your hand is part of you, you think that your mother's hand is part of you, that you think everything is part of you.
I'm not sure.
You have the separation between the self and the other hasn't developed yet.
So what age, is there a certain age when this...
Yeah, 6 months.
6 months, yeah. The idea of separation begins.
This idea that you're different from something else. And then I guess it deepens in adolescence when you think no one has been through what you're going through.
Okay, so according to modern science, what comes first? The feeling, because you're taught there's objects, then the sense of self arises. How does it work?
No, the sense comes first.
Hmm?
The sense comes first.
The sense
Nothing
of self comes
sense
first.
Initially. In the world, you're in the sense. You're not in the context when you come into the world. But you're taking in, because the studies they've done on neonates is that, boy, they're just a mass of cells that are absorbing information. Even if it's undifferentiated, it's certainly not casting.
Yes, but the question I'm asking is, you know, is it because we tell the baby, this is a table, and this is a this, and this is a that? You know, what comes first? The objective world or the sense of self, or they both come?
I think they come simultaneously.
Yeah. They depend
on each other.
I would disagree with that. I think that the child cries when it needs feeding or it needs discomfort of some kind. And knows that as a feeling. It knows something needs to change, but that's not a context. Context comes.
So is the baby actually experiencing
through the mind or through the body, or is it the body?
Okay, well let's think about these things.
All a child knows, early on is a fear of heights. Not a fear of heights, but a fear of depth, fear of falling. They've done experiments to put them on tables of black and white that play with the sense of depth perception. No experience.
It doesn't prove it has felt.
No, it doesn't.
No, it says the opposite.
But as soon as it does, yeah, as soon as the child can see that something is not themselves, then they're conceptualizing.
Yeah, that can be.
Yeah, is that 6 months or whatever?
Yeah. That's why I think that abuse that happens so early in life is so difficult to resolve, because the memory is on a cellular level. This kind of profound trauma that unfortunately some children experience way before they've got any concept of what's happening to them.
I don't know. I think it's still workable. You know, it depends on the approach. You don't have to go back. I mean, now, when I look at a lot of modern psychology, it's still about going back. Yeah. Whereas when we look at Buddhist methods, it's very much about just looking at what is happening in this moment, and then automatically everything else dissolves, or the solidity of these feelings.
That wasn't a question you asked, however.
No,
when a conceptual mind is developed, that takes time. The brain just isn't developed at birth. What is developed is the brain stem, the amygdala, the seed of primitive emotion, not higher functioning. That comes later.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not disagreeing with you.
Okay. And the solidity of self would then definitely come later with as those processes develop.
We're just looking at, you know, how this idea of self, what's needed for the basis of this idea of self. Yeah. And so we need an object. Do we agree with that? Do we need an object? So we can't have any feelings unless we have an idea. You have to have an idea to interpret what the feeling is. Otherwise, if you just observe, you know, the phenomena, there's no distinctness. There's no thingness, is there? The thingness is the concept.
Yeah, thingness, I think, slowly emerges because the child moves and hits a table and finds they have no control over that, and it has a sense of hardness, and I think that's how that. So you mean concepts in the sense of, you wouldn't have a concept of table, a concept of hardness, and a concept of heat. So is that what you mean, that kind of concept?
No, just in general. When we interact with something, we have to have an idea so that the feeling can arise.
Is an idea the same as a name?
An idea, yes, you know, this is a this and this is a that and this is what is happening now. I'm sitting here in Pakok.
So
how would you know you're sitting in Pakok?
So you're saying, as your language evolves?
As language evolves, that's what I'm saying, yes. As language evolves, then the idea of self evolves also. Becomes more and more solid.
Is a feeling an idea?
We have to go into that. That's the second scan. We haven't even got to the first yet. We've got different aggregates, different components that we're going to look at.
Is the feeling the same as sensation?
We're going to look at that. There's both mental feeling and there's bodily feeling. We're going to look. Now we don't define the difference. We think, you know, what we think, we actually believe is feeling.
And
but to actually experience pain, you know, there's many ways to experience pain. You don't have to see pain as a thing.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, a baby will touch fire.
Yeah.
I'll certainly have the sensation. I will slowly learn that this is something you don't touch.
Mm.
And that's how
it's learned.
Learn.
I remember seeing a program about a baby who was they put a glass table over like a, it was like an abyss, and the baby was crawling across it and looking at its mother for sort of affirmation or sort of warning from the mother as to what it was doing. It was its first kind of just learning to crawl, and it was basically learning from the mother what was safe and what was not safe. So independently, it probably very well, if glass not there or there, it would have gone on, off the cliff, so to speak. But because the mother's face showed, you know, no, don't do that, or yes, that's okay, they learned.
What about somebody who is blind or deaf? How would they learn?
So
would they not have any
experience?
The idea proceeds or comes with the feeling. It seems like the idea is constructed out of the feeling of hot pain. From that you construct an idea. It doesn't seem like the idea has to come first. Am I misunderstanding?
No, there's different ways to experience. So, you know, most of our experience comes through memory.
Yes, that's right.
We don't actually experience pain, we experience the memory.
I was thinking of the child game when you first learn, fire is to be avoided.
Yeah.
It learns through the...
Through the
pain. It doesn't have any idea at the beginning. It's building that up through the experience.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. That's why I try to introduce the baby-like attitude as much as I can. All right, let's go on a little bit. Now, anyone remember the definition of mind from last week for the people who weren't there? Here, rather. Rodney, can you remember?
That which experiences an other. That which experiences duality.
Okay. With any something. You have to have this interaction for this definition of mind. Now I'm trying to skip lots of this because we're not going to be able to go very far. So I'm just giving you a very rough psychological survey here. If we're really going to go into detail, then this would take months to really study. It's really fascinating, but you have to be very patient, and then you need to take time yourself, really examine what's being said, look at your own experience, look at your own reactions, see how they work, and then it makes sense to you. Otherwise, if you just sort of listen, it's not enough just to listen. You have to have the contemplation, and you have to have the meditation side of this. And the meditation just means familiarization with another way of seeing. So you introduce these ideas, you contemplate these ideas, and then you familiarize over and over again. You consider these ideas until they become natural. And then your whole perception begins to change. The way you see life begins to change. But it needs application. Everything that we do in Buddhist practice, it needs to be applied. You can't just leave it on the paper. Hopefully I can put this down so that people can read it later. So as I said last week, the mind divides experience into subject and object, and first it identifies with the subject and then with the idea of mind. And then it starts to cling to my body, my mind, my name. And then we find that the attachment to these three ideas grows stronger and stronger. And we become more exclusively concerned with our own well-being. So then you'll find that we're constantly striving for comfort and pleasure and any kind of a little intolerance in our lives becomes a very annoying. Yes. terrible things. Even like a fly landing on your leg, you know, it's really annoying. Yeah, quickly push it away. So we become very intolerant as we become more and more self-centered. So then our intolerance of life's annoying circumstances increases, and a preoccupation with pleasure and pain, wealth and poverty, fame and obscurity, all this is due to this idea of self. And we're so obsessed with ourselves that we hardly ever think about the welfare of others. And the lovely example that I read somewhere is like we're no more interested in others as if, you know, a tiger is interested in eating grass. And this comes from, you know, the habit of being self-centered, always coming back to me, mine, what I need for my pleasure. We just don't have that open view. It makes us very, very narrow. Look at your own feelings. See how they work. You know, when you're involved in your own problems, very hard to appreciate what's going on around you. Everything kind of closes down. Becomes very narrow. Me, my problems, my doing, my pain, my. Isn't it like that? Hard to see. Hard to see that other people might be going through similar things or worse things. The openness kind of shuts down the openness. There's so much self-involvement. So then, this the Bodhisattva's outlook, I think, is the Bodhisattva. Bodhi means awakened, Sattva means being. So the one who is walking this path of really awakening to one's own nature, their attitude is very different. Their attitude is more concerned with others, others' welfare. His amazing strength and courage comes from being concerned with others. So the ego is just a fabrication of thought. And when you realize that both the object that you're grasping and the mind that grasps both are empty of content, then it's easy. It's much easier to see the equality of all beings. Because now, what is it that makes others different from us? Just think for a moment. What makes another person different from us? What makes one person a wonderful person and another person a terrible person?
How nice they are to us.
Yes, how nice they are to us, or how terrible, or what they've done to us. Things that we like, or things that we don't like. And as their behavior changes, or they apologize to us, then the way we see them also changes. And it's constant. Every situation in your life is constantly changing. Nothing is solid. Everything depends on your own concepts and the way you're fabricating what's going on. It's so hard to digest this because since we first learned anything, we've learned that there's an objective world out there and it exists. Nobody has ever introduced us to the possibility that maybe this is just a projection of our own mind. This is just a fabrication of the way that our mind works. Who learned this at school? Well, how many of you learned anything like this? Just to consider this possibility. I certainly didn't.
We learned about Descartes.
Hmm?
We learned things like
go
ability to swim and that kind of stuff. I think therefore I am. It's very similar, not the same.
How about Bishop Berkeley?
Huh?
Bishop Berkeley.
No,
no, he's nothing.
What was that? Would you share that with others? I don't know.
Bishop Berkeley is the sort of idealist in the philosophical debate who believed
that everything was
his mind.
Yeah. Every
well, he was on the Johnson kick and said, is that it?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Johnson kick and said, right, yeah. You tell me that's in your mind?
Yeah, we always come back down to the physical side. If you get hit by a truck, is that your mind? I think there's a very fine line here. You know, we're not saying that nothing exists. It just doesn't exist the way you think it does. You know, that's quite a big difference.
This is something that in the philosophy we learned is that, you know, these are just theories, take them or leave them, whereas the Buddhist view is actually giving you a way to investigate them. Is that the difference? Ideas are not actually unique to Buddhism.
No, I'm not saying that they are unique.
It gives you a way to kind of test it, right? That would be fair to say.
Yes, we're giving you the tools to really examine things and see for yourself, you know, whether what you really believe in has any basis. And for me personally, the more I examine, the more I see how things fall apart. Yeah. I see how it is a mental construction. And then, once you see that, you don't have to. Of course, the habits are going to pull you back constantly. You know, you've always related to it as something solid. So there's such a habit that immediately you feel threatened. Then the object becomes solid again. There you're wrong. You're this, you're that. Yeah. Because with the feeling of insecurity, you know, we've got to have a solid object. We've got to have that object there in order to feel secure. Watch your reactions to things. Think this week. Have you got upset this week? Anybody not get upset or not agitated this week by something? No, this is a basic behavioral pattern. All right, now look at it. This is the way we're going to learn. Now look at it. Think of what made you agitated or angry or whatever it is. How did it arise? How did the experience arise or the appearance arise? What came first? Did the feeling come first or the idea come first? Or did they happen simultaneously?
Feeling.
Feeling.
Physical feeling.
Physical feeling.
Pain makes me agitated and angry.
Pain.
Pain. And then I feel less.
So discomfort. Mm-hmm. Let's keep it simple. Discomfort of some sort.
Yeah.
Displeasure. Mm-hmm. Discomfort.
Hungry.
Yeah. Something that we don't like. So we have. Is there an idea involved?
I see ideas first.
What do you think?
Depends whether you get a physical, pain versus someone annoying you, because that kind of builds up, and then you get angry, versus, you kick something or you get a physical pain, then that's the immediate pain, then you get annoyed with the pain.
Getting annoyed with the pain. Is that concept?
No.
Yeah, you've got to. You're building the idea. You're constructing something. You've got to have the object to get angry. Otherwise, there's no source for the anger.
Something happens,
a trigger, and then the thoughts just kind of build up and build up based on all the times that that's happened before, or something similar. So it's a kind of learned reaction.
It might be externally or it might be internally in your body, but it's still kind of external to your thoughts.
The only way that we can really learn is to look at our own experience. Try to understand the mechanism of the experience.
I have to agree with that, Eric. I think it's the idea first somehow. Because there are all sorts of sensations and perceptions. And all sorts of potentially painful, I suppose, sensations or perceptions, but we don't feel pain. We don't feel that they are all pain.
Mm.
And some people, they feel just waking up in the morning is pain. And some people, they don't.
There are states of mind where the same idea has a very, very different. Like I wake up some mornings and I'm kind of irritated with everything. It doesn't matter what the idea is.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to sometimes begin with a state of mind, isn't it? Rather than an idea. And then the idea is the trigger. The smell and the trigger.
Yeah, when you're tired, sometimes when you're really tired, then you have no tolerance. Little things really agitate you, whereas when you've had a good night's sleep, the same thing doesn't bother you at all.
But you still say the idea is the trigger, would you? Or the state of mind?
I would say no. I would say that there's an idea there. Very subtly, there's an idea that makes you react.
God, I feel irritated this morning. That kind of idea.
Yes, you don't even know it's going on.
Don't you find, Graham? I often wake up like that. When I actually look back and think, if I do, rather than just fighting people, you sort of think, well, it's because of this, because of all that life before. Or, I mean, it's often something very physical.
Because of them.
Well, no, but, people who are irritating are generally irritating in the same way every time you meet them, but some of them irritate you and some of them don't.
That's interesting, because in a sense, where you react to it, do we experience anything new? The flip side of this argument, because one way of looking, if we're very, very dualistic, then, everything is solid and an excuse to react strongly.
Mm.
Yeah? But, in fact, what we seem to be coming to is the idea that a lot of the information is stored inside us already. Then things happen, and we bring our past experience to interpret the new thing happening, but it ain't that new.
It's the fresh attitude, isn't it? Because if anyone's a teacher, has often an irritating student, not bad, but irritating, always talking in Cantonese when you're trying to give instructions. That kind of student, and they're like, oh, it's the same thing. But it's like, what I found in the class is that if, after a few lessons you spot that student, you're always watching them and you're like, Johnson, you come and sit by me or something. And you can start to persecute that student.
Yeah.
And then they hate you.
Yeah.
The whole thing
with
you and Johnson, But somehow, if you can do a few sensible things, like make the whole class move every lesson so Johnson's not in his little place, so he can't be always the same. And then you have this sort of like fresh attitude to irritating Johnson every time. Often, Johnson or his equivalent, just the irritate that they change. It's interesting, isn't it, really? Have you tried that? what Annie Amber was saying, but it's like when you change the situation slightly or approach it in a fresh way, it can all evaporate. The irritation can go.
It seems to me that it's a lot about desire. When I'm frustrated, very often happens when I'm hungry and I
and I want to eat, and then, you know, I have students too who come up and they want from me.
Yeah.
Right? And so what they're wanting is in opposition from what I'm wanting, and therein lies the conflict.
Mm. There's an idea there. There's still an idea that I want this.
Right.
We don't see how fast the thought process and how attached we are to what we think. We really believe in what we think. That's the basis for our reality at this present time. And then we have glimpses, you know, occasionally. There's a gap between thoughts. Occasionally. And then all of a sudden everything becomes so spacious, so open. But so fast these thoughts come again. Take over. So the idea is to be able to be relaxed enough just to let thoughts come and go and become more and more detached from the thought process. We're not trying to stop it. We're just a little bit more detached, a little bit more space so that we can just see more clearly. Really changes one's perception. You can see how we create so much suffering from ourselves. Immediately we attach ourselves to an idea, it's like this. All right, let's go on to it. So all the energy we normally put into looking after ourselves, a bodhisattva would put into looking after others. We just can't imagine that way of seeing life, that openness that's involved in just, you know, dissolving this self-centeredness. Because it's such a strong habit. That's all it is. It's just a habit. Not, there's no need to feel guilty about being self-centered. It's just a habit. We've got to see how the mind works, and then slowly we can let go more and more. We don't have to be so involved. It's very refreshing, very interesting. It's not like you're your own enemy. You have to be a friend first. You have to really see what's going on. We've been our own enemies. I can't remember, since childhood we've always been our own enemies. We've always, I'm not good enough and I should be like this. We just don't know how rich we are, what we have. We've been told what we don't have and what we should have. We're never introduced to our own nature, what we have now. You don't have to do anything. You just have to relax. Amazing, isn't it? That's all we're asking. Just relax. Just let go of these thoughts. Don't always try to build and build, make things more and more solid. So I'm working here, I'm working from a book that I tried to write unsuccessfully. I'm just using this as a kind of format because I have the tendency to just go off on tangents. We never actually, you know, I remember, I think in the old days, I think I was using a text. I think it took the first line of this text. I think we studied it for about a month, so I don't want to do that. So it always feels like, you know, we're actually getting somewhere, there's more, but that's not really it. You know, here we're talking about the quality of understanding, not how much we understand. Look, our education system, how much we understand, not the quality of what we understand, but how we understand. All right. Now, for us in the West, to get into a spiritual teaching, then I think we have to get to the core of it. This is my experience. You know, I've been playing this game, let's say I've been playing this game, or this game, for 35 years. That's quite some time. That's most of my life. It's more than half of my life. I'm 58. So I started to get involved in Buddhist philosophy when I was 21. It's quite some time. So I've heard these teachings many, many times, over and over again. Many great masters from the last century and this century. And it takes time to digest. It doesn't just happen like that. A shift in the way we see doesn't just happen like that. But at the same time, it does. From the moment you walk in here to the moment you leave, your perception is changing. The way you see things is changing. But we don't know that. We don't notice it. We come in here and we think, oh, you know, this is really boring. But then all of a sudden we hear something interesting. Oh, it's not so boring. And then we go on a bit more and it becomes boring again. And this is the way you see. As your thoughts change, so you see like this. You think something's beautiful, and you see a flower and you think it's beautiful, and then you see an odd petal which has shriveled. And it's not so beautiful anymore. It becomes imperfect. Yeah. And then you don't want it. You don't want to look at it anymore because, oh, it's time to go. It's dying. Yeah, put it outside. Whereas before, when the petals were all the way we wanted them to be, that was a beautiful flower. Simple things like this, constantly. As our ideas change, so the way we see changes, and all the attachment and the aversion and the indifference comes up as the thoughts change. Just look at your feelings in daily life. Why do they change so much? Why does one person you have a relationship with, you know, seem like the best person on earth, and then they do something that you don't like? Then what happens to that best person on earth? They change, don't they? What is changing? Is it the person or the way you think about the person? What produces the feeling? Passionate love, and then the next day, you know, full of aggression, full of mistrust. This is what we've got to understand, you know. What is changing? Is it the world outside, or is it the way we think about the world? Where's the basis for our experience? What's real and what's not real? Questions we don't ask ourselves. Anyway, we have to build a really good foundation before we get into more complex practices. Without a basic understanding of how the mind functions, just a little bit, you know, it's no good, all this Vajrayana practice. It doesn't help so much. Because we don't have that basis of just a taste of what we mean by emptiness. The whole of Vajrayana is based on this idea of emptiness, of no substantiality. And then we can begin to visualize, you know, we see things as transparent, light appearances. This is how we need to see the world, not as something solid. It just gives us the tools to be able to see every phenomena in the same way. We think visualization is just limited to the deity or whatever else. But it's not. It's the way we see. It's all about perception. How we create constantly. The mind has this ability to create everything that we experience. And these practices are very skillful. They show you how it works. Anyway, we have two main approaches, and some people feel inclined more to work on an intuitive or emotional level, and others feel this approach is not fundamental enough, and that they want a more scholarly or theoretical approach. And I don't think that these two ways conflict at all. I think we can have both. The theoretical approach is understanding the teachings, understanding certain concepts of the teachings. And the emotional, intuitive approach is the practice itself. So they come together. It's very helpful to have both. But that doesn't mean to say you need to be a great scholar in order to understand any of this. It's not the way. Otherwise, you know, we would say if you had a PhD, one PhD, you were more enlightened than a person who didn't have a PhD or two PhDs, and then you would definitely be a great, you know, on the way. It doesn't depend on how much you know. So here we're trying to neither neglect the need for intuition or intellect, but to combine the two together. And then a real understanding of the teaching must be an intelligent one, and it also has to be a human one. Don't leave it dry. Bring it back to your own experience constantly. Then you see how it all works. Otherwise, they might as well just give you a piece of paper and take on a piece of paper. If you see how it works in relationship to your own experience, then you have the confidence to apply more and more of these teachings. Because you see how skillful they are in the way that they help you see in a very different way, a really open way, fresh way. Less neurotic tendencies, less cause for suffering. Because now we create so much suffering for ourselves, constantly. But we really believe that the cause of this frustration and this suffering comes from something external. It's my boss, it's my class, it's this, it's that, it's a pain in my leg. I'd love to be able to blame my pain for the way that I feel. But I know that it's not really pain that's causing the aversion. It's hard to accept that. Isn't it? Because it feels so real. It really feels that it exists. There's me and my pain. Seems like two different things. Think about it. So the intelligent aspect is the theory, and then the human side is the intuitive, personal feeling of the teaching, and it's a kind of learning process that's involved in the teaching. So we're going to look at the quality of personality and individuality. And this is a kind of survey of the psychology of the human mind. And it's common to all schools of Buddhism. This is the basis of Buddhism. Understanding this phenomena called mind. Everything else is just a support system. All this, all the ritual aspects, just a support system for those who need it. If you don't need it, you don't use it. But for many of us, we're so dependent on props, on supports. So here we're using very skillful props, very skillful supports that help us come back, you know, instead of looking outside always. They bring us back to really looking at, you know, how, you know, what's going on here? What's the actuality? Otherwise, what do we have a statue for? You know, it's not that we pay respect to the statue. It's got nothing to do with it. You know, it just reminds us of our own nature, of our own awakened nature that we just don't recognize at the moment. So then you look around, oh, Buddha's here and Buddha's there. My goodness, every direction is Buddha's here. Don't forget, that's what it's saying. Don't forget. Because we have this tendency to get lost. Lost in what we are thinking about. That's all. If it doesn't work like that, it's not useful. Just a reminder. Reminder of your own wisdom. If you don't need it, don't use it. When I first took robes and I went to my teacher, I said, I want to become an Annie. Didn't even know what an Annie was. I want to be an Annie. I wanted to be like him. I was so impressed by this human being. And I thought, well, he was a monk, so I should become an Annie. Maybe that was the way to, you know, just emulate this wonderful human being. I've never met a human being like that before. And what he said to me, he said, for you, it's just like another acid trip. Just like, you just like the clothes. Probably true. It was the 60s. I just about turned to the 70s. Yeah. And he said, go away and really think about, you know, why you want to take vows and wear these clothes and this, that and the other. And I went away for 6 months. I went back to the UK and I really, really thought about, you know, why? Why is this necessary? You know, why is it all this shaving heads, wearing silly clothes, you know, why is it necessary? What benefit is it? Then I looked at all the other things I could have done with my life, and slowly I just thought, no, I really need to make a commitment. I was so scattered before, I do a bit of this and a bit of that, never going into anything very deeply. And I thought, well, if I really can work with my own confusion, then I don't have to share it with others. And that, to me, was really a way of benefiting not only myself and others. And I went back to him and I said, right, I really think this is right for me personally. I said, I need not only an inner commitment, but I need an outer commitment too. It was a way of simplifying my life. So he said, if you really believe that this is a way to benefit others, he said, then it's okay to take ordination. Otherwise, not for you. You don't have to do it. There are so many different ways that we can approach our own mind. You certainly don't need to put on these strange clothes. But we have to value our own nature. If we don't value understanding our own nature, there is no way that we're going to, you know, follow a path that awakens us. Why? What purpose? There's so many other easier things to do in life. So then the some studies like this is very helpful, because we begin to see more and more clearly, you know, what is the value of awakening our own mind, how it can decrease our suffering and our frustration, how this is really the way to benefit ourselves on a very, very deep level, on the deepest level that we can imagine. So I'm going to introduce a Tibetan word here. And this word is Chö Nompa. Have I got any Tibetan specialists here? Chö, Chö Nompa. Chö,
Dharma,
Nompa. Anybody? Nyonpa. Okay. Nyompa means law. How do you translate this? The law of isness of things.
We haven't got that chapter. I think it's chapter 8.
Okay, so chö is phenomena. Usually when we think about Dharma, we think about Buddha's teachings, but that's a very limited way of looking at Dharma. Yes. What we're looking at when we really approach this word Dharma, it means phenomena, anything. Yes. And then the law of isness of things, really understanding the nature of phenomena. The Tibetans have such an incredible way of saying things. To translate into English many of these terminology is almost impossible. We've given up with the word yeshe. Yeshe means, literally it means wisdom. But we don't translate it anymore like that. Because it doesn't, ye, it's very interesting, ye means primordial being. She means knowing. So, knowing one's own primordial being, yeah, that's wisdom. Yeah. So now, you will see many of the translators just leave the word yeshe, because wisdom doesn't mean anything. In Portuguese, wisdom, the word wisdom, is derogatory.
Really?
Yeah, it's really... I don't know why, the feeling is... not so good when you use that word.
In
translation.
Padma Publishing, they translated timeless awareness.
Yes, timeless awareness.
Well, neither did Rinpoche, and Lama Zampo was saying, Rinpoche would say, it's not timeless, it's everythinglessness.
Everything was, yes. Yeah. But you've given up. This is, you know, as I say, 35 years we've been looking for a translation for this one word. We just don't have a translation for it.
But sorry, you just introduced two words there. The first one was the law of the isness
of things, yes, things, phenomena.
and the second one was wisdom. And are you saying that that's commend, same thing?
Basically, it's here we're looking at how things function.
Mm.
So this is what we're looking at. We're looking at the components. Whereas with wisdom, we're just looking at the nature itself. Intelligence, the nature itself. Slowly, let me go on. So it means almost something which is predictable, something you can interpret or see the pattern of. This is Chenampa. When we look at how the mind works, we can actually see a pattern. You can actually see this happens and that happens very fast. So it's not necessary to understand everything on an intellectual level. But it is helpful to understand a few ideas, a few concepts. And it's very helpful to do some practice because you work directly with your own experience. Otherwise, again, you're always interpreting with your ideas what's being said. But when you actually really just watch what's happening, let's just sit for a while. Okay, just let's sit. So I'm going to ask you to hold on to one thought. You're only allowed to have one thought. Okay, is it possible just to have one thought? Can anybody hold on to one thought? You can hold on, Graham?
Yeah, of course not.
Well, you're nodding repeating, your head there.
Like, or bump, like repeating it.
Repeating it,
yeah.
Apple.
How do you know I'm thinking apple?
That's what I'm thinking next time. It's all right, Graham. I've thought it before, I'm sure. Anyway, so there you are. You're learning something just by looking. Yeah, this is the point. We've got to observe how our own mind works. Okay, so we see what happens. One thought arises. Where does it go, that one thought? Where does it come from? Where does it come from? Just take one thought. Don't take one idea. Just one thought. Where does it come from?
It's like there's a machine in your brain that's pushing.
Hmm?
Sorry. It's like a machine in your brain that's
things out.
Like one of those bubble machines.
Yeah.
A bubble machine.
Yeah. And then they dissolve. After it comes up and it just turns.
Where does it come from?
That, I don't know.
Proceeding one.
If you trace it back, I mean, you can see a kind of chain of thoughts, can't you? Where they actually come from originally.
But what if it's the first time?
When's the first time?
Yeah. How long does it stay?
A thought moment.
Yes, well, in the study of metaphysics of Buddhism, they would give you, you know, a time frame for each thought. They would say, you know, 50th of a second or whatever. They've looked into this. Remember, they've had 2,500 years to look at this. They didn't have television. So, this is what they did. You know, this was their main study. And then you have the whole teaching, incredible teaching of Buddhist metaphysics. Now, Western psychology is just beginning to study this. So, watch. Ask yourself, where does that thought come from? How long does it stay? Where does the thought go to? Just watch. Looking. If you really keep looking, then you'll find that the thought process will become transparent. But if you get carried away with thoughts, then again you get lost in the thought process. A great master, Digo Chenzi Rinpoche, he used to say, the last thought is gone, the next thought hasn't arisen yet. What is there? And you don't just do this for 5 minutes. You do this for months. The last thought is gone, the next thought hasn't arisen yet. What is there? Over and over again. It's only by doing this that we can see. It's like a coin, isn't it? It's like a Zen coin. The last thought is gone, the next thought hasn't arisen yet. What is this? What is this, sir?
Actually, on the occasions when I've been meditating and there is this sort of, yeah, that's maybe the sort of feeling of spaciousness, right? Between, but you know, it's very quick.
Very quick.
And
in the beginning, very quick.
But if you meditate for a while, and then, I mean, you can't manufacture it, if you try and wash the breath, then every now and then there are these little spots.
Yes, it's like when the clouds separate and there's the sun just for a moment, and then the clouds come back in again.
Short periods.
That's what we're, that's all. This is practice. In the beginning, it's just like that. Flashes, glimpses. One glimpse, and there's gone. And then you relax again. Another glimpse. And then the thought process itself becomes more and more transparent. You don't have to change anything. You don't have to manipulate anything. You just have to see. So there's a big difference between putting something under a microscope and seeing it with your own eyes, or just purely analyzing the topic, isn't there? What's the feeling? What's the difference? You see something directly, or you just analyze it.
Do you mean analyzing it without having seen?
Without having seen, yeah. A lot of scientific discovery is about analyzing things.
Do the experiment, you actually see for yourself how it works. But of course you need the theoretical background of the experiment, the knowledge of its place in other experiments, and the hypothesis behind the experiment. But I guess that comes back to what you said initially about scholarly endeavours versus practice.
Or concept versus seeing, is that
Yes, concept versus seeing, you know, seeing directly. What gives you more confidence?
Well, seeing, I mean, you take the sort of analogy of science. I mean, doing an experiment makes you really believe in that. But then you're only looking at your experiment, which is quite limited. Unless you know it's emblematic of a, or it's somehow part of the phraseology doesn't stretch.
What do you think? What? Just the difference between analyzing something and actually seeing. What gives you more confidence?
So it depends how you see it. It's like experiential feelings of awareness, as opposed to if you see something directly, like there's difference. You know, you, when you kind of almost like a, you can call it a realization. But I think that comes after the after actually analyze something, you then you might have some conclusion at the end. That's probably more believable than just observing something, I would say.
Do you have to oppose them?
No, you don't have to oppose them.
I mean, you can see something or have a vision or something, and you dismiss it because you haven't got a kind of framework to put it in. You think, oh, it must have been something I ate or something I drank. So I think the two have to go together, and you have to have some kind of analytical framework to make sense of what you're seeing. Otherwise, you ignore what you see.
Possibly.
I think you have to do both.
Being a teacher, concepts for children. Say a mathematical concept, if they can pick up something and move it around, they understand it in a much deeper way than if you just explain it to them with words. So to me, I think the experiential is a more powerful understanding.
Yes, for me personally, I also think that having studied years of philosophy, you see how many different views you can have about the same thing. You know, actually seeing gives you the confidence, so much confidence. All the different philosophical views really fall into place.
You're telling us not to believe what we see.
Hmm?
You're telling us, I mean, not to believe what we see.
On a physical level, don't believe what you see, but on an experiential level, then if you're looking at your thought processes, if you don't believe that there's one thought arising, then you're really stuck, aren't you? You've got to work with some basis. But this, you know, we're working, we're not saying it's always going to be like this, but in the present moment, we're just observing, you know, what is happening. And what's happening? One thought arises, another thought arises, so fast. And somehow what happens is we put these thoughts together. If you change them around, they don't make sense, do they? In order to have a concept, you've got to have a certain order to your thought process. And yet, as soon as we say, this is beautiful, we actually believe it. So then we think it comes from the object side. So fast, it's such a strong tendency though. You have all these filters, which are all the seeds of these filters, which is kept in your what we call the eighth consciousness. And then, in different situations, all these filters come up, and they make you see things in different ways. So fast, you don't know it's happening. Why we have desire for some things and aversion to others. It doesn't just happen like that. Look at senses. You have five senses, six senses in Asian philosophy, because your thought process is also a sense. So then what do you see with your eyes? What do you hear with your ears? It's not something we even consider. Because the way we see our world is so solid, we forget it depends on our senses. We cannot experience anything unless the senses allow us to integrate the information. So fast, there's a moment of seeing, a moment of hearing, a moment of thinking, a moment of seeing, a moment of smelling, a moment of this, moment, 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 moment. So fast. So you think that you're just looking at me, but there are endless moments of consciousness taking place. And then the sixth sense, the thought process is putting it all together. It's a switchboard. It takes in all the information from the five senses, and then it puts it together as a whole in a concept. This is a something, or this is happening. And yet there's so many moments of consciousness coming together. So what do you actually see? What do you actually hear? Do you hear a dog barking? Do you see me? No, you don't. You don't hear a dog barking with your ears. And you don't see me with your eyes. all the sixth sense. The sixth sense is interpreting everything through concept and then bringing it all together, and then you actually believe that you actually see something. It's fascinating to understand how this works. It gives you so much more space. The possibility that the way we see life is an illusion. Now, when you hear that, it's very nice words, but it doesn't mean anything because you can't see how it works. But when you begin to understand how the senses actually work, then you see how you're creating the illusion. So for most of us, we have a tendency to be satisfied with theory instead of being freer and more open in terms of actual experience. And I suppose this tendency comes from wanting to make secure what we're doing. Because all our actions come out of insecurity. We don't know if we exist or we don't exist. And so there's this tendency to always create the idea that we do exist. And in order to do that, we have to have an object. So we have to constantly create the subjective world. Try to have a taste of this mechanism. We don't know if we exist or we don't exist. You really don't know. So this constant level of insecurity.
So is it like we've got a stack of information coming in through all these feeds, and it's too much, really, it's just too much. And then suddenly we'll kind of selectively hit on something, make that a thing, and that's where the conceptual awareness arises from.
Yeah.
Because we can't handle, it's not like we can have a concept arising from every sense input. It's just too much to handle. We're not broadband, we're really dynamic.
That's right.
It's a tiny little strand of wire and a massive brain.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. It's totally two-way intelligence. Our ego only functions two-way intelligence. When you can relax, then everything becomes totally spacious. There's no limits. There's just awareness itself. But whilst we have this two-way intelligence, then we have to have a subject and an object. That's the only way we can function. And all our habitual patterns are based on this two-way intelligence. What were you going to say, Eric?
I was wondering if awareness was directional.
No direction. Just a state of being in itself, but it has its own intelligence. It sees very precisely.
So dualistic view is like a dialectic in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because the input is always coming and the interpretation is trying to always come, but it can't quite handle it. But it's a sort of to and fro thing.
The way that we function at the moment is we function with the six senses, and then the seventh consciousness. We talk about eight aspects of consciousness, which I'm trying to go into. We haven't begun yet, but we'll see that the seventh consciousness is really the kind of basis of ignorance. It's constantly clouded. It will never let us see clearly. And then the eighth consciousness is really all the seeds of our experience. And as the information comes up, then these seeds also come up. They're filters constantly clouding the way we see. So we interpret things in different ways. It's like a source of memory. we call it a storehouse consciousness, because it stores all the seeds of experience, both confusion and liberation. Everything comes from this eighth consciousness. And to see how they all work constantly together, then, my goodness, it's real eye. That's how it works. This is why I feel like this. This is why I experience things in this way and that way. It's just wonderful to have that understanding of your own experience. Why you experience things in certain ways. I'm not saying it's going to stop your aggression or your anger, because the habits are so strong. But the more we see little bit more clearly, a little bit more clearly, it reduces the tendencies. It's like you've always seen things a certain way, and then all of a sudden you see it in a different way. Well, the first time you don't believe it. But then again, you begin to see it in a different way, again and again and again. And then your old way of seeing, it doesn't have the power anymore. So then your habits and your tendencies become much weaker. You don't believe in the filter system so much. Much, much easier to catch. This, yeah, here I go again. Or here we go again. Same process, same habit, nothing new. So, mostly on the whole, when we come to meditation, I think if we're honest with ourselves, then we have to accept that we've been very foolish. But we have to begin with our confusion. And because in the beginning we're kind of leaping into the unknown, and this is it's a source of insecurity. We don't know what we're doing. So at the same time, we're trying to secure ourselves in some way, because we don't know what we're doing. So there's a kind of a double edge here in our meditation. You know, we want to feel secure, and at the same time we're working with this poor sense of security. So we just need to just sit in a very relaxed, light way, and just observe how things come and go, come and go. Then more and more we begin to see a more transparent, transient nature to the phenomena. Less and less solid. People look very tired. Maybe I should stop. You're right, Danny. Your eyes. Late night last night.
Allergic. Huh?
You're allergic to something?
Yeah. Oh.
What is it, the pollen?
I think it's just a change of air, change of temperature.
You're right. You need something? Some water? Any questions?
You talked before about that sense of insecurity in relation to ourself and our inner self. Can you explain a little more about that?
Basically, because we don't know if we exist or we don't exist. So it's always there. It's
so there's an underlying sense of fear, unease, uncertainty.
Yes,
that
all the time.
Makes us go seeking dharma and all sorts of other myriad things in life.
Yes. Really. All our emotions come from insecurity. Then we have to make the objective world solid. Then we feel secure because there's something to relate to. If there's something there, then I must exist to perceive it. Can
you
understand
it? If you look at externally, most of us are besieged with bills. We're besieged with this responsibility.
You brought this up before. I remember this question, the same thing. I think at the same moment I said this before, you said exactly. And I remember this precisely. You brought up the same thing.
Absolutely.
No, it's true. You're very practical. Very practical.
I didn't understand. Is she arguing that we exist because we have a lot of bills?
I'm just saying there's so much that confirms our identity externally. I'm so worried about. I'd like to get away from all.
Isn't it quite interesting, though, sometimes to just imagine what would happen to all your possessions and your friends if you just dropped under a bus or something? You know, you go out in the morning and then you never come back to your flat.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of. Do you ever imagine that? It's quite interesting. Mm-hmm. It's quite horrible in my
life. You write your will.
I can't imagine dying and all the stuff in my flat and all the things
that
attached
to
it.
Yeah. But it's different if you've got a terminal illness or something. You can plan. But if you just go under a bus.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of immediacy we should be living with the possibility of...
The bills don't stop, Sarah.
But you don't care.
But Annie, when you talk about the insecurity and that basic fundamental feeling that drives us to create our world in this way, what's the antidote? Seeing? Observing your own
insecurity? Yeah, seeing things clearly.
Watching the mind itself.
Yeah. Yeah. Seeing the whole process, it's one of the, for me personally, that's one of the fastest ways to cut through this tendency to solidify everything. Because you see all the sequence. Again, I come back to John McKenzie because he has such wonderful examples. And I don't know if you were there at the teaching, but he said, imagine you go out at night and you see a person, he has a torch, and he puts the torch in the oil, and then he lights the torch, and then slowly with his hand he makes a circle, and then all you see is the circle. Now you've watched all the conditions to make that circle of fire, but if somebody just comes in who's never seen anything like that, then the fascination with the circle of fire will be far more than the person who's actually seen all the conditions to make the circle of fire. And this is us. We don't see the conditions that make up our life. We just think it's all solid. It doesn't depend on anything. It doesn't depend on our mind, doesn't depend on different elements, nothing. So this is what is helpful to see, the conditions that we depend on for our experience. And then we don't have to believe in it so much. Play with it more. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's a very skillful tool.
Isn't there also a strange way to start to perceive that yourself isn't?
Sorry?
But isn't there also a stage when you start to see yourself could be impermanent and maybe even is empty, and actually that's quite scary, you know? It's not that.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't seem to spell fear, it seems to, for a while, it might actually make it a bit scarier.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wrote down.
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, that's exactly what I wrote here. So in the beginning we try to practice, and rather than really meditating, we just imagine we're meditating. So then the whole thing is based on confusion. That confusion is accepted as part of the path. So there's no need to feel guilty about confusion. It is the path itself. And so it's wonderful to understand, you know, this is what we're working with. We don't have to whip ourselves all the time. I'm this and I'm that. We understand why we have so much frustration, dissatisfaction, and all the other kind of neurotic tendencies that we have. Because because we don't see, we don't recognize our own nature, then slowly we begin to relax more. You're not trying to change things. It's the ability to see what is happening. That is what will change things. It's because you don't see what is happening, then you're controlled by all these conditions. You see the difference?
It seems to me that an essential thing for all this to happen in my experience is to slow down. It seems like when I'm busy and I'm running around, I can't see things. I can't see the process happening. I get so involved in things.
Mm-hmm.
It's, for me, it's only been in the last couple of years when I've forced myself to really slow down and take time and relax.
You don't know how to relax. The tendency is to manipulate, to always try to get things the way we want them to be. And when they don't go the way we want them to be, frustration, suffering, pain. Relaxation. We think relaxation is lying on a couch. We haven't been introduced to mental relaxation. Mental relaxation means just letting go. Whatever comes up, just see how it comes and it goes, comes and it goes. That's the first stage that really is so profound, to be able to see how phenomena are changing moment by moment. Then, once you can see the flow, you know, sitting by, you know, my old analogy, sitting by the side of a river. You just keep your eyes one point in the river, and then you don't look up the river, you don't look down the river, you just observe. Whatever arises, whatever comes into your view, as you see it, it's gone. As it comes, it goes. As it comes, it goes. As it comes, it goes. And that is the actuality of the phenomena. Yeah? We're not creating anything. It's so important to see this. Because then, why would you want to hold on to it if you could see that it's changing moment by moment? Why would you want your you could see how it's causing you suffering. Because it's not the way it is. It's not permanent. It's not unchanging. What's the purpose of holding on to it? Because you feel insecure. So in order to feel secure again, you have to hold on to something. And then, okay, got it. You have a taste of this mechanism? A little bit. It takes time. You need to hear this again and again. Different ways we'll approach this. What time is it? 4:20. Okay, let's have another 10 minutes. Can you stand another 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Or sit another 10 minutes? Mm-hmm. All right. So we're leaping into unknown territory. And I think for most of us, this is very frightening, because in the beginning we're just not sure what we're involved with. But I'm afraid this is the only way that we can get into practice. We have to jump into our own insecurity, not run away from it. And then our confusion. You can really see how the confusion is the path. And then more and more you don't run away from what's happening. You just look at it, observe it. And then this this funny nature of ours. It slowly begins to reveal itself more and more. So if you see your thought process as clouds obscuring the sun, I think that's a very helpful analogy. If you go up to a cloud, this is not my analogy, this is a very ancient analogy. If you go up to a cloud and you poke your finger at the cloud, you know, there's nothing there. It just appears as if there's something there. And this is the thought process. You know. Now, when we think something, we actually believe in it. It appears as something solid to us. It appears as an object. But when you really look at it, you see there's nothing there. It's totally insubstantial. It doesn't exist unless I give it the power to exist. As soon as I believe in these projections, then the ego has something to play with. So then we see a tremendous amount of fear involved and a certain amount of security is needed. So in the beginning of our practice, there will always be fear. And there will be a need for security. You'll watch this with your own mental agitation. Very hard just to sit and observe. So, by looking at your own insecurity, it helps you see how the insecurity works. And then once you step out of this concern for security, then the way you see things, it becomes very personal, and a lot of kind of relaxation takes place, because now we're not always trying to secure ourselves. We just relax and let whatever come up, just let it come. And go, come and go. You don't have to manipulate anything at all. We discover the more we let go, then the more comes back to us, rather than losing our grip of something. And then a real relationship to your situation begins to develop. So I think the greatest problem is that spiritual teachings have been used in a way of securing ourselves. So how we've used our spiritual teachings is a way to gain stability for our ego. If we're really honest with ourselves, this is how we've used our spiritual path previously. We may not like to see this, but it takes quite a while to be honest enough to let go of this tendency. But this is our starting point, so don't feel bad about it. Just be honest with yourself and how you're using your spiritual path. We can't ignore this. There's no need to push it away. We just start with our mistakes, and working with our mistakes, there always seems to be a problem. And there's notice that there's fear and there's need for security. So once there's fear and need for security, then it makes accepting spontaneity or being present, it makes it very difficult. Because we're always trying to secure ourselves in some way. come to the first aggregate form. So that was the kind of introduction to the five aggregates that we're going to talk about. So I think we'll leave that there today. And those of you who were at the teachings of His Holiness the Drukpa Rinpoche the other day, then he gave a long teaching on form is emptiness and emptiness is form. This is a little different. This is going to explain to you how other is created, any other. And that's the starting point, just this feeling of other. Then we build on that. And that's the meaning of form. Now, as soon as you have a sense of other, it's not form as we know it. We think form. But this is a sense of other. All right, let's have a cup of tea. And before that, let's have a dedication.
So the dedication is on the second page. Dedication is on the second page. And we'll do some long prayers.
Yes, please explain before, you know, why do we do dedication? For those of you who haven't been to Buddhist meditation or teachings before, then we try, in the beginning we try to look at our motivation. We try to make our motivation include others. So why am I here? I'm here not only to work with my confusion, which will benefit myself, it will also benefit others. And in the end of the teachings, we consider all the positive energy that we may have created together here. And don't just keep it for your own benefit. Also consider others, how wonderful it would be if each and every being could benefit from this positive energy. And this constant, considering others in your motivation, it really opens your heart. The feeling of this self-centeredness begins to melt more and more. So we have to familiarize ourselves with this more open way of seeing, more generous, more open. So then we do these prayers at the end of our practice, and we also say long life prayers for our teachers, because they're very, very precious. Without them, we wouldn't really understand these teachings. So, thank you.
Throughout my many lives and until this moment, whatever virtue I have accomplished, including the merit generated by this practice and all I will ever attain, this I offer for the welfare of sentient beings. May sickness, war, famine, and suffering be decreased for every being, while their wisdom and compassion increase in this and every future life. May I clearly perceive all experiences, its insubstantialist dream fabric of the night, and instantly awaken to perceive the pure wisdom displaying the arising of every phenomena. May I quickly attain enlightenment and learn to work ceaselessly for the liberation of all sentient beings, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas all together, whatever kind of motivation you have, whatever kind of beneficial action, whatever kind of wishing prayers, whatever kind of omniscience, whatever kind of life accomplishment, whatever kind of benevolent power, and whatever kind of immense wisdom you have, then similarly I will come in the same way to benefit beings ready to attain these qualities. At this very moment, for the peoples and the nations of the earth, may not even the names, disease, famine, war, and suffering be heard. Rather, may their moral conduct, merit, wealth, and prosperity increase, and may supreme good fortune and well-being always arise for them. Rinpoche's long life prayer. Namo Guru Mantra Shri Amen.
Before we all get up,